Welcome to the MJA podcast. I'm chatting this afternoon with Dr. Nigel Strauss, who is a consultant psychiatrist and medical director of the Millswin Clinic in Melbourne. Hello, Dr. Strauss, and thank you for your time.
Hi, Kate, and thanks for having me.
You've written an article for an upcoming issue of the MJA about psychedelic drugs and the resurgence in research into psychedelic drugs and what they may offer for mental health illnesses. Why is there such a stigma about psychedelic drugs? Why are we so scared of them?
That's a good question. I think the main reason is that back in the last century, back in the 60s and 70s, when these drugs were initially being researched, mainly in North America and Europe, they escaped, if you like, from the research environment and got out into the community and to a certain extent were abused and caused all sorts of problems.
Yeah.
And there was almost a political reaction against their recreational use. And these drugs were all banned, and they became Schedule 1 drugs. And unfortunately, as a consequence, any research was banned as well. And therefore, for a long time, nothing much happened. It was generally a reaction to people using these drugs inappropriately and without medical supervision. There's no doubt that there were significant problems as a result. And so the stigma came about really because of that and has stuck up until the present time. These drugs are potentially dangerous and very potent drugs, and I believe that they should not be used recreationally, and in no way am I suggesting that at any stage they should be used recreationally. My concern is that these drugs may have some medical potential and that research into them under proper clinical control is worthwhile, considering results that are coming out of North America and Europe. But certainly at no stage do I believe that these drugs should be used recreationally. I think they're potentially dangerous drugs under high circumstances, and I do not advocate their recreational use. I think that people were very frustrated and upset by the fact that these drugs weren't allowed to be researched for a number of years. There were some very promising results came out of the early research work, although the standard of methodology wasn't all that good necessarily. There were some very promising results, and people were very upset that they couldn't go on researching. And so there was always an undercurrent of a desire to do that research. And I think that a number of people kept that momentum up. And eventually there was a recent flowering of the research again. And now the momentum is increasing all the time. And the number of articles being published is increasing exponentially.
Tell us, first of all, about the recent research in MDMA.
Well, that's probably the most advanced research in psychedelic medicine that's occurred so far. And it's happening in the States. And up until now, there have been phase one and phase two studies, and the phase two studies are completed, and phase three studies are about to begin, and they've received the support and approval from the United States Food and Drug Administration. Now, the trials are for people with post-traumatic stress disorder, and the results so far are very promising, and hopefully the phase three studies will also show good results. Of course, there's never any guarantees. It's still research work, but everybody's very optimistic that the medicine will be effective in the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder and eventually will be used in a clinical way to help people with post-traumatic stress disorder, because many people today who have post-traumatic stress disorder do not receive adequate treatment because adequate treatment is not available. It's not because people don't want to help them, but effective treatments are not available to a large number of people with post-traumatic stress disorder.
So tell us about psilocybin.
Okay, well, the other drug, psilocybin, which is being investigated, three studies came out last year in relation to that. One of them was in The Lancet, done at Imperial College. And these studies are all small because they're very expensive. And then this one treated people with treatment-resistant depression, which is not uncommon with the people with depression. There were 12 people in the trial, and the results were interesting. All of these patients were found to have a reduction in the treatment severity after the treatment, and 8 of them achieved complete remission at 1 week, and 5 still had complete remission within 3 months. There were no serious or unexpected adverse side effects, and any of the side effects that did occur were all transient, so there were no long-term side effects.
Okay.
These results were promising. Now, I should emphasise at this point, Kate, that whenever these psychedelic medicines are used, they're always used in conjunction with psychotherapy. They're not just given to someone and someone comes back 6 or 8 hours later to see how you're going. There is preparatory psychotherapy sessions. The people who undergo the trials are always supervised by 2 therapists. And then following the trials, there's intense integration sessions which follow for several weeks after, so people can integrate what actually happened, come to terms with what actually happened in the session.
Is that because of the mind-altering so-called effects of these drugs?
Well, I think it's partly because of that, but also it's very important for these trials to be done at very high standard with very rigorous methodology. And, of course, the people who, say, oppose these trials need to be convinced that there is adequate supervision in these trials, they're safe, and that people aren't left alone, that there's always someone there to assist them if anything does go wrong. But so far, there haven't been any significant adverse side effects. So that was the first trial. But the other 2 trials that are equally interesting came about as a result of a collaboration between the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and New York University. These are 2 trials, both with larger numbers of people, looked at people who had a so-called existential distress or depression and anxiety associated with life-threatening cancer. They'd all been given a diagnosis of life-threatening cancer. And understandably, these people had emotional distress. But there's a large proportion of people who are given the diagnosis who never come to terms with it and remain extremely distressed until the end.
Yes.
And so palliative care, which we all know has become increasingly effective and sophisticated, very treating the physical side of life-threatening conditions. In other words, pain management now is at a very high standard, and most people have their pain treated satisfactorily. But treating the negative psychological syndromes associated with these diagnoses of cancer, treating the depression and anxiety is a much harder task. And current psychiatric treatments, such as antidepressants, have very low efficacy. And so these trials came about because it was thought that we needed to look further afield for effective treatments for these people. And this is what initiated these 2 studies.
That raises an interesting question of what role these drugs can play in the euthanasia debate, which, of course, is firing up big time down in Victoria.
That's right. Well, look, it's fascinating, actually. Let's accept that these drugs are effective because both trials showed that the antidepressant effect and the anti-anxiety effect of these drugs in the participants was quite significant. 83% in the first trial showed a significant antidepressant response, and 58% showed a significant anxiolytic or decreased anxiety response. These changes were maintained to a significant degree 3 to 6 months later. So let's assume that these trials show that there is evidence that these drugs do work. Now, the debate that you've raised that's going on at the moment in relation to euthanasia is very much based, in Australia anyway, on possibly making available euthanasia to people who have incurable or unbearable suffering. There's a paper that your journal published, an excellent paper. It's a review paper that was published earlier in the year called Euthanasia and Physician-Assisted Suicide. It's a review article by a chap called Emmanuel. It's a review of studies done in the States on why people choose euthanasia.
Yes.
And what the public perceives as the reason why people choose euthanasia. Now, what's interesting is that there's a real disparity there, and this is not well known in Australia. This is strong evidence evolved in this. The public support for euthanasia is closely linked with the reasons patients want these interventions. Most of the public support euthanasia, but only for patients with excruciating pain.
Yes.
But in fact, what's interesting, Kate, and this is what we need to get out there, I think, is that pain does not appear to be the primary factor motivating patients to request euthanasia. That's fascinating, and I don't think people realise it. It's this so-called existential distress, depression and anxiety, a sense of hopelessness, yeah, helplessness, isolation, dependency. That's the reason that people, by far the most common reason that people request euthanasia. It's not pain. The pain can be managed. It's mm-hmm. the psychiatric aspect
yes.
of this terrible diagnosis that's not being well managed, and this is the reason why people request euthanasia. And so I think that really needs to be publicised and discussed in this debate. I say it, of course, because I think that the research that's going on at the moment in relation to psychedelic medicines, particularly for people with a diagnosis of cancer, is one, these people are asking for euthanasia not because they're in pain, but because they're demoralised, they feel hopeless, they feel depressed.
Yes.
And the second reason is that I think this research indicates that we may be able to manage this. I'm not saying we're going to be stopping people from requesting euthanasia, but certainly there's a possibility, and I only say it's a possibility, that in fact, if we pursue this path of psychedelic medicines, we may be able to limit the number of people who in fact request euthanasia. And I think that's an important point.
I'm old enough to remember the 60s, believe it or not, only just. And my memories and perceptions of psychedelic drugs being so popular in the 60s is because they had they could change your worldview.
Yes.
Is that a temporary thing? Is it something that can be turned into a life-changing thing rather than just a depression-changing thing?
Those who have gone through the treatment and have had the so-called mystical or peak experience that these medicines initiate, many of them agree on the subjective experience that they have. Now, we are talking about a phenomenological perspective, about a subjective experience. And so, therefore, we have to rely on narratives, on what people tell us. But what they tell us is that they go through this profound experience, which I can describe for you, and that it does have a permanent effect for many of these people in their worldview. And it's sort of life-altering. And so in the case of someone who has a diagnosis of cancer, a terminal diagnosis, it's believed that their attitude changes permanently. And in those who have gone through the research, that's what happens. And there's a sudden, if you like, turnaround, and they can cope with the diagnosis. They are no longer demoralised. They're, in fact, given a different worldview, and they undergo a profound personality change. They reinterpret the world, and this is a permanent change, and it's lasting. So it's fascinating, but this whole concept, of course, as a psychiatric treatment, does alarm a lot of people. It unsettles established
yeah.
thinking. But the way you view things
yeah.
Apparently alters to the point where you're no longer caught, stuck in this sort of negative perception of the world, identifying with yourself as a dying person. You see things in a much greater perspective, and you are said to go through an experience in which you have this profound sense of unity with all things. You're not just identifying with yourself and your dying body, but you're identifying with the entire world around you. It's a much said to be a deeper and more comprehensive view of reality. I think words really can't describe it. And I haven't had that experience in that sense. So you can only rely on the people who have gone through
yeah.
that experience and the changes that have been observed in those people under very rigorous conditions. It appears to be a genuine change, and the results of these studies are very positive. And I don't think one needs to get alarmed and say, "Oh gosh, you know, you're creating monsters or Frankensteins." it's not as complex as that. It's simply people see things differently,
yeah.
and it has a positive effect on their depression and their anxiety. They are much more positive. One of the interesting things that came out of these early trials is that, in fact, the experience of pain that these people who were suffering from terminal cancer diagnoses had was much less. It was an analgesic component to these drugs. Now, that may not have worked centrally. It may well have been that because people were coping with their situations more effectively,
yes,
they were more positive, their experience of pain was lessened.
Okay, so how is the Australian academic scene? There a resistance out there?
There's strong resistance, Kate, yeah. Unfortunately. I've had personal experience with this. I tried to set up a proof of concept study at a well-known Victorian university where I am have been an adjunct professor, and we developed a pro forma. We attempted to present it to the ethics committee at that university, and it was rejected. It wasn't even considered because it was considered to be too controversial. And I realized, and that wasn't all that long ago, it was a year or two ago, and I realized at that point that it was pointless for me to keep knocking on doors, and it was better for me to try and get this message out there that there may well be some great benefits in this research. I'm not saying that the research is going to absolutely prove that psychedelic medicines work, but we need to do the research as it's being done quite openly and freely in North America and in parts of Europe, because Australia needs to keep up. We need to be involved too, because if these drugs do work, we need to be part of that. And the main reason is to decrease human suffering, to help people. And I think that psychiatry should be involved in Australia in this research. I speak as a clinician who wants to initiate the research, and we want to make sure that this research, if it ever does happen in Australia, and I definitely hope that it doesn't, the research is done to very high standards, and that it's, you know, anyone can come and be part of it and who's properly qualified, and make sure that the methodology is of very high standard, very rigorous. This is not, you know, whimsical stuff. This is the important stuff, but it's got to be done properly, and it's got to be done in a university ethics committee situation with support. And I hope that in the future, and I don't know how long it's going to be, that a university does step forward, has the courage to say, yes, it's worth a try. And that's really what the academic world should be doing. It should be investigating new possibilities, not saying, oh, it's all too controversial, but supporting research that may be of great benefit. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nigel. Thank you for your time. Well,